Hello. Okay. Let's get started. My name is Neil Kring. I am one of the pastors at Ball State University Church. We have a church there. Actually, not a pastor of Ball State, but at Ball State. And this is a guy named Nick. He's in our church. He's just a guy. He's just a guy. And Nick is a therapist and is going back to school to get his PhD. And he is kind of an expert in all these matters that we're going to be talking about. But I knew this guy before he even knew the Lord. So had the privilege of being a part of him coming to know the Lord back in the day. And look what a fine young man he turned out to be. wearing vests and sweaters and everything. So he's the he'll be the straight man here today. And not, you know, like I'm the funny one, he's the straight one. You guys understand that? You guys know nothing about comedy? Okay. He's the serious one, okay? But what we're going to do here today is we are going to talk some about depression and anxiety. And mostly we're going to be talking kind of about our own stories and our own journey. I'm kind of the expert on anxiety from an experiential perspective, and he's the depressive expert because he struggled a lot with depression, and we'll tell you guys some about that and how God has moved in our lives, some of the healing that we've experienced, and where we're at in our own journey with that stuff. So Nick is going to start off by putting on his therapist hat and giving some of the statistics and clinical information about depression and anxiety. Might be interesting to you. It might be not. Might not be. But I think it's important, at least in the sense of trying to understand what a struggle this is. And I'm assuming that most of you guys have some kind of connection with depression and anxiety, either for yourself or with someone that you're close with. You know, this is, there's a lot of, you know, working in college ministry, I know that there are a lot of people that I talk with regularly that struggle with these things. So you're not alone in a group, really big group of people who are fellow strugglers. So here you go. Yeah. Did I just turn that off?
I don't think so. No. Look at this cord.
It's a big cord.
Just in case.
You want me to just hold this? I'm over here.
It's going to tether me.
We can do jump rope.
If I, actually, just give me that. Yeah. Just give me that. It's going to be real weird. So if I start talking too soft, you guys just let me know, because I get real quiet, and so I apologize for that. I want to keep the clinical remarks really to a minimum. I just want to give you guys some basic information about what's going on college campuses in terms of depression and anxiety. That's where most of you guys are. It's where most of you guys live. So I just want you to kind of have an idea of what's going on around you in terms of that. So you can put up the first slide there. Actually, you'll have to advance it. Yep. So this is taken from the National Institutes of Mental Health. So this is where I got this information from. 1 in 3 people on college campuses report struggling with depression. So all of us in here, when you guys walked in, we had you draw little cards, 1, 2, and 3, and I would say all the threes stand up. That would be how many of you in here struggle with depression, clinical depression, not just I'm feeling kind of sad, but actual depression. So less than 25% of you who have depression, you won't seek help. And so there's approximately anywhere from 75 to 85% of people who struggle will never go and get any kind of help or support. I find that fascinating, but that a lot of that has to do with stigma, I think, access to resources. Therapists, we can be expensive at times, and what's available on college campuses sometimes isn't exactly what people are looking for, but there's improvements in that, so yeah. Professional help. Yeah. So his question was, does that include talking to family and friends, or is it just seeking professional support? And it's seeking professional support. That's what that statistic relates to. Okay. You can go on to the next slide. 85% of college counseling centers report an increase in the prevalence of mental health concerns. Before I went into private practice and before I went back for a doctorate, I worked at a university counseling center for about 4 years. And each year we saw an uptick in the amount of people that would come to see us. And, you know, for a lot of times in college counseling centers, it's people who are coming in just wanting to kind of talk about growth and life. And that got to be more and more severe. More people with depression, more people with generalized anxiety, more people with bipolar disorder, more people with trauma and abuse. I don't know if you guys know this, but 1 in 4 women have been sexually assaulted prior to the age of 18. 1 in 4 women are survivors of childhood sexual abuse, and approximately 1 in 5 men are. Those are staggering statistics that we see a lot on college campuses. Suicide, this blew my mind, is the third leading cause of death among people ages 15 to 24. It's you. It's the third leading cause of death. And depression and anxiety and mental health concerns obviously are highly correlated with that. So, okay. Anxiety, just in terms of kind of what that looks like, approximately 14% of people over the age of 18 report struggling with, again, diagnosable clinical anxiety, and I'll talk about what that means. And this often co-occurs with other issues like depression or like substance abuse, things like that. I always say to people that I work with that depression and anxiety are like perfect partners. They're brother and sister, best cousins, whatever you want to call it, peas in a pod. Like, they always seem to kind of go hand in hand with one another. It's pretty common. So, okay. So depression, kind of just some, I'm trying to boil down some kind of characteristics of what it kind of looks like, because a lot of people kind of have this conception that depression is, it's basically someone who watches a lot of Oprah and eats ice cream and is like just sniffling in their bed all the time, and that's like what depression is. And that's really not, depression kind of looks different than that, so you can go ahead and put some of these up.
Maury Povich.
This is the big thing with both depression and anxiety. It interferes with your daily life. Like, I mean, it's you don't want to get out of bed, you struggle to get schoolwork done, you show up late for your job, you don't perform well at your job, you're bailing on relationships that you normally wouldn't bail on. For example, I just had this kid that came in to see me, 17-year-old kid. His mom said, I knew something was going on when he decided not to play football this year. And he's never not played football in his entire life. So you don't want to do things that normally you find a lot of enjoyment from. It's interfering with your daily life. Okay. Some kind of things you can feel, sadness, pessimism, kind of like an emptiness. And so I'll tell you about my story here in a little bit too, but emptiness and pessimism are kind of my, they're my go-to things when it comes to feeling depressed. And anger. This one I think is oftentimes overlooked in terms of someone struggling with depression, but people who have a lot of anger sometimes or just seem to be very mad at things, sometimes that can actually be an anger that's inward, and that can be depression as well. So, and physical problems, you know, maybe you're tired all the time, you're sleeping, you're either sleeping way too much or not sleeping enough. And that doesn't account for Red Bull, okay? You know, these kinds of things that we do to keep ourselves awake, or and you know, and this also doesn't mean, oh well, Nick didn't do good on his test because he was up all night playing Halo Reach. Well, no, I was just up all night playing Halo Reach and not using my time wisely. That doesn't mean I'm depressed because I bombed on my test the next day. So, you guys understand what I'm saying with that? That there's a difference there. Yeah. Okay. All right. And suicidal thoughts. A statistic I read was that for those that, well, 9% of college campuses are now experiencing suicides on a somewhat regular basis. So 9%, let's just say there's 500 universities across the country. So 10% of 500 would be 50. So 50 campuses a year have something of a suicidal attempt or an actual completion of some kind. That's a staggering statistic for me to think about. So,
how would you define suicidal thoughts?
You guys hear that? How do you define suicidal kind of thoughts? What does that look like? In the clinical world, we talk about the difference between having thoughts and having a plan and having an attempt and these kinds of things. Thoughts would just be like, I think all of us at some point have thoughts that say, in my mind it goes, I wish I could just kind of crawl under a rock and not exist right now. Or I kind of want to just go away. I don't want to deal with this. I just kind of wish this was over.
Those, I would say, are more mild on the side, but when it gets into this idea of actually thinking about what it would like be like for you to not be around, or making plans to not be around, or thinking how you would want to do that, so there's a continuum of thoughts and what that looks like. And anytime anyone expresses any kind of thought, I don't care if it's on this end of the continuum or this end of the continuum, I think, you know, we ought to step in and ask what's going on and try and be there for them in some capacity by talking to them, encouraging them, getting them support. Some thoughts on anxiety. Okay, keep going. Again, it's got to interfere with daily life. Excessive worry. Again, this is a continuum, kind of a scale, right? I'm trying to think of some examples. As Neil begins to talk about some of his story, I think you'll kind of understand what I mean by excessive worry about things that are just everyday life kinds of things that all of us have struggles and stress, but it's when that stress kind of punches through a threshold that we're thinking about it all the time. It's keeping us from doing things. It's keeping us from going to work, or it's keeping us from getting our work done or focusing, or maybe we just kind of surf Facebook all night long. And, I mean, these kinds of things we're avoiding. That's when it's kind of punching up to a higher level. Perfectionism, which is kind of tough because perfectionism is like a socially acceptable thing to some degree, right? Like, we want people who do really good work, who are really good at what they do, who are highly motivated. So in some ways we can reward this inadvertently, right? But perfectionism is a form of anxiety. It's an anxiety about not having it all together, about having to be right, about fear of being judged. Ruminating thoughts, racing thoughts, like they just don't stop. You know, it's like you lay down at night to try and go to bed, and it's like you just can't turn it off. I mean, it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And it's worrying about things that may or may not even happen. That would be some examples of that. So, okay. So I wanted to get through that real quick. And if you guys have questions about any of that in greater detail, come talk to me afterwards. But I wanted to give most of our time today to kind of talking about kind of our experiences and walking through this, because I think it makes some of that information come alive a little bit in a real way. So.
Am I starting?
You're starting.
Okay. Go for it. All right. So, you know, I have always known that I have had issues with anxiety my whole life. You know, my dad got a job when I was in first grade. Or got hired on with a new job. In my entire life growing up, I remember him telling us that he is about to get fired. He was about to get fired. And this was from the time that I was 6 years old until last year when he retired. And I am not kidding you, every time I saw him, he was saying, well, they're making cutbacks at work, and I'm probably going to get let go. And I literally hundreds of times I heard that from him. And I always thought, my dad, man, he is just out of control, anxious. What's wrong with him? You know, why does he have all these problems? Why can't he just relax and trust God or whatever? And as I've gotten older, I've seen that I have also started to become that way a little bit myself. And I mean, I've always worried about things. I've worried about irrational things. When Y2K happened, you know, I was just like convinced, you know, I didn't want to be foolish enough to be one of those people who made plans to do anything about it, but I was really worried about it. You know, I pictured myself sitting in front of my front door with a shotgun, like just blowing people away that are trying to come in and steal my food. You know, but those were kinds of things that, you know, when I could laugh about them. I realize it's kind of silly and ridiculous, but I worry about all kinds of things. I worry about finances and are we going to go broke, or I worry about what happens if I left ministry and I don't have anything. You know, I probably would not even be able to get a job at McDonald's, and what if, I don't know, just you name it. What if my kids, you know, hate me because of all the choices that I've made? But anything that's significant in life, I could just spend any amount of time worrying about it. And I think over time that has increased. And especially, of course, now I'm probably in the middle of a midlife crisis or something, but it was all kind of coming to a head, and I've struggled with depression or depression-type symptoms for the last, I don't know, 7-8 years after a really significant event in my life happened on our campus. I think ever since then, yeah, I would just feel depressed and down. It started with like just around Christmas time and around winter time, and then the last 3 or 4 years, it's just all the time. Just feeling down and depressed. But I was able to do my job for the most part. I was able to function, able to kind of keep going. And we went to a staff conference this past year. And man, I was just about to die. And I think I maybe had talked with a couple guys that I was there with about how much I was struggling and how hard of a time I was having. I just didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be around people. I just wanted to get out of there. There was nothing encouraging about that time, motivating, inspiring. I thought, why am I in ministry? Why do I keep doing this? I've got to get out of this. And I was so scared that right when I got home, I got on the phone and I called this guy who's a counselor that I've seen over the years and said, I was like, this is an emergency and I need to meet with you in the next couple days because I'm really scared. And he emailed me back and he was like, come in tomorrow. And we just sat down and talked, and I just felt so out of control. And I was telling the pastors that I work with about how I'd been feeling, and they were like, Neil, man, we've been talking about you should probably take a sabbatical. And I was like, but there's really no good time to do it. I'm supposed to be directing LT, and then there's no way I can do that in the fall. And they're like, well, do you have to do those things? Yes, I do. There's no way I can not do this. But what kind of condition are you going to be in if you keep doing this? You're a wreck. And we can see that. And they would just kind of gently urge me, hey, let's talk about you taking a sabbatical. You know, it just kept coming up in conversation until finally they were like, Neil, you're taking a sabbatical. And I knew, man, I was crashing. And I was going downhill, and I went to LT for the first 7 weeks and of LT, and it was a hard experience for me being there, knowing that I'm going on sabbatical right after that. And that time, I think what that time did is it took away all the things that I had been running to escape my problems and to keep me from not having to think about things. And I started going to see a different counselor because thought, hey, you're on sabbatical, have a new experience, whatever. And this woman, the first time I sat down with her, she said, Neil, have you ever thought about maybe you have an anxiety disorder? And I was like, I mean, I know I'm anxious a lot, but I don't know why you would say that. And she said, well, I have this little test, and it's like 6 little questions. And if you answer yes to 3 of these questions, you'd be clinically diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And so we went through the question. I answered yes to all of them, except for one of them. And then a couple weeks later, I would have had to answer yes to that one too. And she was like, now that doesn't mean anything except that you would be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And there's different ways you can deal with that. I mean, obviously trying to figure out what's going on, face some of these fears that you have, maybe go on medications. And I was like, I'll keep coming to counseling, but that's all I'm going to do. And so I kept going. Every time she'd ask me, like, What do you think about medication? Oh, I'm not opposed to medication. I got friends who are on medication. It's not a big deal. Well, have you ever thought about you going on medication? And I was like, yeah, I've thought about it, but I don't believe it would help me. Because I've been like this for so long. I can't imagine that taking some pill is going to help me deal with some of these things that I feel so deep inside. And she brought it up. Then my pastors caught wind of it, that she had recommended that to me, and then they were asking me, Neil, have you ever thought about taking medicine? And why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you just try it? And you know, it's not like it's going to kill you or anything, but maybe it could have one side effect that could be beneficial for you. And so I eventually decided that I would take medication and went and talked to my doctor, and she went through this thing. She's a believer, and she's known me for a long time, and she just started crying in the office. And she was like, Neil, I just feel so bad for you and where you're at and how much you're struggling, and I know this is really hard for you, and I know that you don't want to do this, but I just want to assure you that we can get to a place where it could help a little bit. Maybe just a little bit. If you stay in counseling and keep working through some of these things, I hope that you'll feel better down the road, you know, and I believe you will. She prayed for me. It was a really cool experience. And I walked out of there, and I like cried when I walked out of there. And I thought, what is the salty discharge coming from my eyes? And I didn't even know why I was so upset. And so I started taking this medicine, and then about a week later, I went and hung out with Wayne Wager that weekend. We had a really good time, came back. I'm getting ready for this roofing project. I wake up in the middle of one night, and I am crying. When I wake up, I'm crying. And I just feel so out of control. I'm so upset. I don't know what's going on. And I probably went on for like an hour. Then I woke Kelly up, and I was like, I don't know what's going on. I can't stop crying. Life is just not going to work out. That's all I could think. Things are just getting worse. You know, we're headed for disaster. I was saying those kind of things to her, and she was kind of half awake, and she was like, let me pray for you. She prayed for me, and by this point, I'm just sobbing. And then she starts singing, and I always hate it when she sings. I'm always kind of annoyed. I'm always kind of annoyed when I hear people sing. You know, just kind of, it's off key a little bit, or I don't know, it's just annoying to hear that without like a band or piano or something. But she's singing, and I'm just like, I don't care what noise I'm hearing. It's just good to hear something. It's like the first time in our marriage that she ever like sang, and I didn't make a comment about her singing. I know, she has lived under severe oppression for a long time. And any of you who know her know that's true. But anyway, she kind of fell back to sleep, and I'm still crying. I might have fallen back to sleep for an hour. I wake up the next morning, and I'm just crying. We went to go pick up some stuff for the roof. We're in Menards, and I just start weeping in the middle of Menards. You know, there's people walking around. I just can't hold it together. I walk out to the truck, and I just sit there, and I'm just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know. She's like, call Jeremy. I got a friend, Jeremy, who's a doctor. She's like, call Jeremy. I talked to him. He can't even understand me on the phone. I'm crying so hard. And, I can't even explain to him what's going on. I just know that everything in my life is going to hell. I'm going to lose my job. The kids are screwed up. This is just not going to work. The roof is never going to get done. I'm going to lose my job. What if I lost my job? What would I do? I have nothing to do. I've wasted my life. And I'm saying all these things to him. He understood probably half of it. And Kelly was like, I don't know what to do, you know, with you. And so she called up Mark, who's one of our other pastors, drove me over to his house. We sat down with Mark and his wife, and I'm just crying and telling them, you know, all these things. And I'm just completely, I can't stop crying. Fortunately, that day I had a counseling appointment. It was like 2 hours later. Go to this counseling appointment. I'm just crying through the whole time. I can't hardly say anything. And she's looking at Kelly. What do you think about, is this normal? Does this happen? Kelly's like, I've never seen this before in my life. She was like, when was the last time you cried? And I was thinking, maybe when I watched Extreme Home Makeover like a year ago. So I don't really know what's going on, but she asked me, she said, what are you so sad about? I was like, I am not sad about anything. I'm out of control. Life is horrible. It's going downhill. Things are, disaster's about to happen. You know, all these things that I was saying, and she didn't buy that. So later on, when we were getting ready to leave, she said, Neil, what are you so sad about? I was like, I do not know what I'm so... I don't know why I'm crying. I don't know what's going on. I mean, part of it might have been a reaction to the medication I was on. But part of it was just the floodgates, I think, had just burst open. And I was out of control. I cried for like the next day straight. I was like, what do I do when I go home? I pick up my kids from school, and all I can do is cry. She's like, well, have your kids ever seen you cry? I was like, you know, when we were watching The Blind Side, maybe, or something like that, but no. She's like, well, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for your kids to see you fall apart like that. So I got them, picked them up. We're sitting in the living room. I'm just bawling. And I'm going to be like this for a while, and I don't know what's going on. And, you know, and they were like freaking out, and you can just come over and rub my back, or, you know, so they're sitting over next to me, and eventually, over the next couple days, I'd start crying. They just kind of look up from their video games, and they go back, not even notice I'm doing it. But over those next couple days, I had to, you know, I just had to have someone be with me the entire time. My wife was going to work the next day, and I called Josh and Ryan, and they just sat with me. I think Ryan and I, was it you and I that walked around the mall? Just walking around the mall, I just have to do something, but I'm crying while I'm walking around the mall, and sitting in the car, and I was like, Josh, will you pray for me? We went and worked out. Josh, will you pray for me? And, you know, he's praying for me, and they just kind of sat there and were just there with me. And I was so desperately afraid of something, but didn't realize what it was. And as I continued to go to counseling, we continued to talk about this. And my counselor had asked me a question about, had I ever felt this way before? When I was crying the first time, and I told her that it had happened one time like this where I felt this out of control, and it was when I went to Wilderness LT maybe like 8 or 9 years earlier, and I just fell apart out there. You know, I've stood on the edge of a cliff and for 10-15 minutes, like, literally thought about jumping off the cliff. I thought, man, this will ruin the Wilderness LT program. This will ruin Daryl and everything he's trying to do here. And what about my family? And I kind of just snapped back to sanity. And, you know, just, I was like on the ground, beating my fists, weeping on the ground out in the wood, not fully knowing why or what was happening. And then after that was over, I just walked away with it and decided I'm never going back there, and I'm never looking back there, and I do not even want to know what happened there. But there's a kind of a common thread that my counselor kind of helped me to realize was just this desperate fear of just being left out there alone. And so most of my anxiety would relate to that, you know, just this fear that I'm going to be alone. Everyone's going to leave me. God's going to leave me. God doesn't care about me. He's not with me. He's with me by default. You know, and I've been a pastor for 12 years, and I've given messages about God's love. I even gave a pretty good message about God's love that past summer. At least I thought it was good. But I didn't believe a word of it for myself, and couldn't, and struggled with that, and my counselor just kind of helped me to, rather than continue what I'd been doing, which was to run away from those things, to just face it and just say, okay, well, let's just start looking at it. And I'd go into for counseling appointments over the next couple months, and it'd just be a weep fest. You know, all she had to do is ask me one question and give me that look. I'd just be broken and feeling so vulnerable and exposed and not knowing what to do. I asked her if I was bipolar. I asked her if I was schizophrenic. I asked Kelly multiple times if she just needed to drive me to the psych ward. And, you know, that just thinking, I talked with Nick. I remember he and I were talking one night, and you know, I'm just crying, and he's sharing things with me, and I just think, what... But one thing he told me that night is, he was like, Neil, one thing I think that can help you get through this is if you can remember that it's going to get better. It's not always going to be like this. And because I was probably at the lowest that I've ever been before. Maybe I'll be lower than that at some point. But up to this point, I've never been at that place. And I just, when I would start crying, I would just give up all hope that anything was ever going to change in my life. And I just kind of held on to that. My counselor had been telling me the same thing, just thinking, okay, this is not going to last forever. So while I'm in it, maybe I can just embrace it and just, if I'm going to cry, I'll just cry. That's what my counselor was saying, you know, if you're going to cry and fall apart, just do it. What's so bad about that? Well, but what if I'm crying for 2 days? Well, then you cry for 2 days. She said, you probably won't, but if you do, you do. You know, because this is a part of one of the things with anxiety that I guess I've learned through my own experience is that a lot of times, I know for me, I probably didn't feel the weight of my anxiety because I was always running away from it. But when I made a decision to try to start facing it, that was when the weight of it really hit me. Like, these are really fears. And I'm just saying the craziest things to the people I'm hanging out with about things I believe about God, things I believe about myself. And it's been for me kind of a whole rebuilding process of trying to kind of believe things that I've heard my whole life about Jesus and about God and His love for me, but trying to really believe that about myself. I've got this little app on my phone, and it's got a bunch of notes, and I just open that thing up and I just read these notes that I wrote down about God, that He loves me, He cares me about me, I'm not alone, there are people that care about me. You know, it's like, remember that Saturday Night Live skit from a long time ago, that guy that looked in that mirror and he's like, people love me. You know, I do that. I'm doing that with my phone. People love me. Carl loves me. Josh loves me. Ryan loves me. You know, they're not going to walk away from me. And if they do, God will not walk away from me. And His love for me is personal and it's intense and it's, He wants to be with me. He likes me. You know, and I've told myself that, and maybe I'm starting to believe some of that stuff a little bit. But the anxiety that I have felt, I think what happened is it's been there for a long time. It's just kind of burst forth. I still have moments of crazy insanity where I just think everything's going to fall apart. It mostly comes out when I think I just got to quit my job. But then if I quit my job, what would I do? I've got a general studies degree from Ball State University. I mean, some of you guys, if you're on staff or in ministry, you think I'm going to quit my job and I'm actually going to go make some money. I think I'm going to quit my job and we're going to be destitute. We are going to be living on the streets. We're going to be homeless. And I believe that, you know, in those moments. I believe that is the reality that's going to happen. So for me, it's been a process of just saying, okay, well, what's the reality? And what would happen if that did happen? I told my counselor, I said, man, we're broke. We don't have any money. We're struggling with debt. We're, you know, all these different things. And she was like, well, financial peace isn't the highest virtue in the world, is it? I was like, yes, it is. You know, if our money was better, I'd feel happier, or whatever situation. She'd just be like, well, that's not the most important thing in the world, is it? And then I'd have to think through, well, okay, I guess it isn't, you know. And maybe having God reveal Himself to you at this place is better than having some of the things that you really want. So that's kind of been my journey. We could talk a little bit more about that. But I know Nick, be really good to hear his story too as it relates to the depression that he's struggled with and where he's at in that process.
So ridiculous. At the end, we're going to kind of wrap up with some practicals, suggestions, kinds of things. So that's forthcoming. So, you know, I think for me, it's different for everybody, but depression for me has really been an anger that's kind of, it's been like a self-loathing kind of anger, you know, and it has its roots in all kinds of different things, but probably the place where it comes alive the most is in my family, right? You know, that's what our families do, right? They mess us up. And I don't know if I heard amens or if I heard groans. No. I love my parents. But, you know, for me, essentially, I kind of grew up in the... I had to write about this the other day, actually. The word I chose was quintessential. I kind of grew up in the quintessential blue-collar, middle-class neighborhood in suburban America. You know, my dad was a worked in a factory, essentially. My mom stayed home with my brother and I. That was kind of our life and our existence until I turned about 10. And then my dad got diagnosed with a really, really heinous disease called multiple sclerosis. Anybody familiar with that or kind of know what that? Yeah. Okay. It's really awful. And essentially what it does is your nerves are coated with this protective barrier. MS deteriorates that barrier. So your nerves get crossed and wired differently, and you lose motor function and skill and coordination. And it can eventually, over time, if it's really aggressive, can lead to death. And so at the time I was 10 years old, my dad got diagnosed with MS. And this was back in the late 80s, so there wasn't a great deal of medication or treatment at this point. It was a lot of just kind of wellness and exercise and some experimental medication. So watching him kind of deteriorate physically, there was an emotional deterioration that happened. Same thing with my parents' marriage, and same thing with the relationship I had with my parents. So I went from essentially losing a dad physically and emotionally, and seeing my parents' marriage fall apart, and kind of sitting around questioning and wondering all the time, what the heck is going on? Why is this happening to me? I kind of always retained some belief in God growing up, but I really didn't care to have anything to do with a God that lets crap like this. I wouldn't have said crap, but I have a microphone on. Crap like this go on. You know, I just couldn't do it. It was too big of a stretch for me. And so I get to college, and up until this point in my life, I wouldn't say that I was a depressed kid. You know, I think I was probably a bit of an erotic kid, just kind of wired, kind of anxious. But, you know, there was always this desire and this drive in me to push myself to be really good at whatever I did. Because if I was really good at whatever I did, maybe my dad would notice me more. Maybe my mom would pay attention to me more instead of getting lost in this kind of new thing that had just come out called the internet, you know, and AOL. Remember AOL? You guys don't know AOL. And so, you know, it's like anything I could do to get my parents' attention, because the life of a family struggling with multiple sclerosis had just sucked our relationships down into that tube. And so there wasn't, I just kind of felt alone on an island. And my brother, if he was here, he would kind of say the same thing. So I get to college, and, you know, college was great because it was the perfect escape from my crappy life at home. That's kind of how I thought. It's like, hey, this is a chance to kind of get away from all that junk, to kind of reset, to kind of do things differently. And so that's honestly what I did. I just totally forgot about my family experience as best as I could. I just didn't even want to think about it. I didn't even want to deal with it. And this would have been in 2001, the summer of 2001. This is the first time I went to LT. This was in Colorado LT. And I was out there with probably a group of about 10 or 12 close friends from our church. And anyone went to Colorado LT? Housekeeping staff? Woo! Yes, yes. Oh, gosh, housekeeping staff. So many memories. So that was my job. For the two LTs that I went to, I was housekeeping staff. And we were out on the cabins, I think, somewhere. And Brad, who is the director of kind of the whole housekeeping laundry organization. If you guys ever met Brad, you know, he's this really wily guy that wears Hawaiian shirts all the time, has a yellow blonde-haired mullet, real nice guy. He comes up to one of the cabins to find me and says, hey, I just got a phone call from your mom. You need to come down and take this phone call. It sounds like something happened to your dad. It's kind of serious. And I said, oh, gosh, okay. So I get back down to the office and I take the phone call. And my mom says that my dad's in the hospital just getting out of surgery. He had surgery on his colon. They had to resect part of it. And I said, MS does nothing to the colon. Like, what? Why in the world is he? Well, I came home. Well, he had called the ambulance himself because he had gotten out his old Springfield rifle, was cleaning it, and then pointed it at his stomach and pulled the trigger and shot himself in the stomach. And I thought to myself, and she said he's claiming it was an accident. He was near the phone, called the emergency people to come. Come on, I'm the first kid in my family not to go into the military. Guns have been in my family for a long time. People know how to handle guns in my family. It was not an accident. He's deliberately trying to commit suicide. And maybe he just got scared at the last minute and aimed lower. I don't know what happened. But essentially at that point, so that was towards the end of the summer, I left LT early. Went back home, flew home. That was in August. So we're plotting along. September 11th happened a couple months later. That's 2001. And then a month later, my dad died. Essentially, just because he was so messed up from all the surgeries and being so weak already and just, you know, hospitals. So his body just couldn't handle it. He couldn't sustain it. And so I was at college when I got the phone call that he had passed away, went home for the funeral, kind of came back from the funeral. I took about 3 weeks off. I still was able, somehow, I have no idea how to salvage my semester and still finish strong. And so it really wasn't until the following semester that I think all of this started to catch up with me. It started to catch up with me, you know, what had happened. And as I look back on it now and as I think to myself about how this has impacted me, someone asks me, you know, like, what was grieving like for you? And I say, well, I feel like for me it was not grieving so much what I had. It was grieving what I will never have. So, you know, with my dad being sick and then with me becoming a Christian, I always thought in the back of my mind, hey, well, maybe someday I'll be able to have some kind of a restored relationship with my dad, a reconciled relationship with my dad. And then when he passed away, that kind of disappeared. And so there are certain things I think that as guys, we want to hear from our dads. And when in the back of your mind you think, maybe I'll be able to hear that someday, to you're not going to hear that someday, to a kid that already struggles so much with wanting to prove himself, wanting to be validated, wanting to be kind of seen as someone who's got it together, that's just like a recipe for awfulness, you know. And awfulness it was, you know. So for the next several years, depression for me essentially looked like you would never have noticed, except for one thing really, is I put on a ton of weight. I went from weighing about 175 pounds to weighing about 225 pounds when I was at my heaviest. And that was really the only outward sign you could tell, is that I was just numbing my emotions with just kind of sitting in front of the TV, playing video games and eating food. And I didn't want to do anything that I normally would want to kind of do. And so, and I just kind of tried to keep it all together and act like everything was okay. But on the inside, it was just this war going on with me about, again, just feeling like, where the hell is God in all this? And why am I being, what the heck did I do? So again, it plays into this irrational belief I have about myself. Well, Nick, if you weren't so messed up and if you were a good person to begin with, maybe this stuff wouldn't happen to you. Maybe, you know, you would have had a family situation that was better. Maybe God would speak into this experience right now. It just, I felt like if I were to talk to God about it, it was essentially silence. I might as well have been having a conversation, you know, with this floor. You know, it just felt pointless and hopeless. And so for, I would say, a good 3 or 4 years, that was kind of the reality I walked around in, was these kinds of feelings. But on the outside, I tried to act like everything was okay. I'd still talk to my friends. They'd ask me how I'm doing. Oh, yeah, I'm doing great. Everything's okay. But on the inside, it was just awful. And through my experiences and going to, I sought counseling for the first time during this period. Prior to this point, I thought counselors were a bunch of idiots. And it's funny that I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars to learn how to do that, you know, to become a counselor myself. But that was part of the experience, you know, for me, of becoming a counselor, is going through my own healing with that. But as I was going through that own, my own healing, the process for me has been stripping apart just layer after layer of lies, layer after layer of trash, layer after layer of just things that are not true at all about me. Not true about my experience, not true about my dad, my mom, my family, any of this. And that has been horribly painful to do. And someone asks me what it's like. I equate it to, and this is a really horrible mental picture, I'm sorry, but it's the only way I can think of this. It's like it's like having your skin peeled off, you know. So I'm sure this is a, when clients come to see me and they talk to me about the process and what it's going to be like, I'm pretty open with them that I'm not here to really make you feel good. I really don't think that's the role of therapy, is to make you feel good, so to speak. But in a sense, I want to help peel your skin back. And I want to make you look at things that you don't want to look at, and that you choose to avoid, or maybe you don't know you're avoiding, but things that you need to examine and look at in your life and make decisions from. And that's what the experience has been like for me, and that's still my experience now. I feel like with each year and with I've gone to counseling a couple times now. I have a therapist back in town that I really respect a lot, and every now and then I'll call him up and go chat with him, and it's just a process of peeling back those layers. That's the second summer I was at LT. This would have been in like 2004, I think, or 2003. This is when John, you were leading the ship at this point. And I remember John gave a talk that summer that I actually tried hunting for the cassette tape of that talk the other day, and I just couldn't find it in our old box of it. But he called it junk tapes. You remember this?
Yeah. Junky tapes,
right. And that has stuck with me. So that was like, what, 7 years ago? That stuck with me so much. And that's kind of how I equate this process. Like, I had these tapes full of crap that would just play in my head. They just fed that depression. Just fed it. It's like the spiral just pulled you down. And until I was willing to stop and look at those tapes, pull those tapes out, and tear them up and say, this is bull crap, and I got to find a different kind of thing to play in my mind and fill that with God's love, fill that with His truth, fill that with relationships that have come to mean so much to me, and let them be the hands and feet of God in my life. That was the turning point for me, and beginning to slowly walk out of that. And I'm still slowly walking out of that. But that's been part of my journey and part of my experience. Just that horrible cycle of believing a bunch of lies about yourself. That's been my experience. So what do you do with all this? We just say, okay, go in peace, you know, serve the Lord. We kind of just want to offer you guys some practical kinds of things to consider. Either one for yourselves, if these are some things that you guys struggle with, or two, for friends that you guys may have that might be struggling with these things, or family members, just some kind of things that you can offer them. And this isn't an exact science, but we've kind of tried to rank order these in terms of what we think is probably the least difficult to do down to what is probably some of the more difficult things to do. So we'll kind of start with the easy first, so to speak, and then kind of work our way down. Again, don't hold us to that for sure, but you can throw up a slide here. Go on ahead. Being open with those that are close to you. Again, that may not seem easy, but in terms of the other things we're talking about, you know, what we would encourage you to do is, where there are things in darkness, bring them into the light. You know, if you're struggling with this anxiety, with this perfectionism, or you're struggling with this self-loathing and with this hating yourself, talk to someone in your life that you care about that you can begin to just bring that into the light and become open about it. I've been amazed at how things feel so big and monstrous on the inside, and then when you open up and talk to someone about it, it kind of makes that monster shrink down to maybe like a little troll or something, okay? It's like, it's still there, but it's not as big. And also, I think that something about people are the hands and feet of God, the church, the body, that's what we're here for. We're to be the hands and feet of God. How can I be the hand or the finger or the ear or whatever to you if you don't open up to me about it? So, and when someone asks you how you're doing, don't say fine. Don't why. Just be honest about how you're really doing. So, okay. Exercise. Okay. I was just telling Neil the other day, the periods in my life where I regularly exercise a couple times a week, whether that's racquetball, treadmill, whatever it may be, just I feel better, you know? There's something about exercise physiologically. I could bore you with the neuro details of it, and I won't. Let's just say there's chemicals that get released in your brain when you exercise that make you feel good. And so it's an important thing to do. It also alleviates some of the stress and tension that gets built up inside of us. And we were built for work. I think that's how God made us. God made us to be rigorous working people, not necessarily couch potatoes. And so that helps us a lot. This kind of sounds like I'm being a smart aleck, but I'm not. Doing things that non-depressed people do, doing things that non-anxious people do. And this is a tough thing to do. So if non-depressed people get up off the bed, They go hang out with their friends. They go work out. They participate in church activities. They go play ultimate frisbee every Sunday afternoon in the quad. Then get up and do those things. Don't wait for your feelings to catch up and tell you you ought to be doing that, because sometimes your feelings aren't going to catch up. But you'll be surprised, and once you get up and start doing those things, your feelings will catch up to what you're doing, you know, if that makes sense. And so that can be a tough one to do. But I hear this all the time. And this was true of my experience too with my clients. But Nick, I just don't feel like it. I know you don't, but you have to do it. You have to make yourself do it, because that'll help the feelings to catch up.
And I think that the same thing goes with anxiety. One of the things I think when people are struggling with anxiety, there's a lot of trying to avoid the things that make you anxious. But the way to deal through anxiety is to put yourself into a place where you start facing the things that make you anxious. And that's really hard to do. But that's the process, or part of the process of healing, is to do those things.
Yeah. Okay, man. Counseling, and I wrote professional and pastoral here down both. You know, that, like I said with that statistic earlier, there's 85% of people, 75 to 85% of people who won't get any kind of help that need it. And I think a lot of times that's sometimes just access to good quality care, right? But sometimes that's a stigma. There's like the stigma associated with counseling. There's a stigma associated with going and talking to someone about your problems. My father-in-law, I love him a lot. He's a funny guy. You can tell kind of tongue-in-cheek sometimes. He kind of thinks my job profession is a little, why do you like sitting around hearing people whine about what's going on in their lives? You know, and it's kind of that stigma, right? That you shouldn't need to have people help you with your problems. You should be able to put your big boy pants on and get it done yourself, you know? And so, in terms of also pastoral, you know, I'm all for people seeking pastoral care and counseling, especially when it pertains to, I think it goes both ways. I think pastors get themselves into trouble with counseling with very severe kinds of issues, and I think therapists get themselves into trouble when they're trying to counsel people about matters sometimes it would be best dealt with by their pastors. And so wherever that is for you, your comfort level, you know, don't be afraid to seek out your pastors or seek out any type of professional services and counseling. And a lot of times on college counseling centers, the services are free to you as students, you know, and you may not always be able to connect with someone who's necessarily comes from a Christian background. And if you can at those places, that's great. But if you can't, I could again bore you with a bunch of research, but you know, there's research that supports that that's not always the number one issue. You know, counseling is a lot of what you invest and what you put into it, and any well-trained person is going to be able to help you out. And so if you can't get that, at least you know, consider thinking about there. So okay, medication. This is not for everybody. Okay, so we're not blanket saying, hey, everyone who has depression or anxiety needs to be on meds. That's just not true. You know, it's just not true at all. I've taken medication before, and it just didn't really work for me. It didn't help me. Didn't support me. And so I stopped taking it. And for some people, it really does. And for some people, I would say it's the minority, you know, and that's not a bad thing, but it's more of a long-term kind of thing to help manage, and that's perfectly fine. For a lot of people, it's a short-term to kind of help. You know, it's like breaking a leg and you need to wear a crutch temporarily until you begin to get energy back in your leg and rehabilitate. Sometimes medication can be seen that way. And so, again, I think there's a lot of stigma associated with this, unfortunately. My brother has a heart condition. It requires him to take medication from time to time. There's no doubt in his mind. He takes the pill and he puts it into his mouth because it helps his heart. You know, and I think that our field has a long ways to catch up in thinking about mental health in that way. You know, that when there's things going on, it's no different than struggling with other types of issues. So,
I think too in the church in general too, there's been kind of a stigma against medication, and I'm not sure exactly where that came from. I think over time there's been a lot more research, there's been a lot more science behind it that I think nowadays maybe the church is a little more open and accepting to that idea in general. Because I remember feeling just really against medication, but having no good reason why. You know, it's just, there just was something that seemed unspiritual about it. even though I take medicine for high blood pressure, I take medicine for asthma, I take medicine for acid reflux, you know, and other things, or if I've got a headache. But there's something about taking medication for a mental problem that just seemed wrong. You know, I didn't want it to change who I am. And it hasn't changed who I am, but it's probably helped just enough, calm me down and help me to focus just enough to be able to do it. And that's why I said something about that yesterday in the message. And I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, one of the most helpful things that you said was that you went on anxiety medication. And there's something about realizing it's okay to do that. Now, that isn't the answer. I don't believe medication is the answer to fixing my problems. But medication is a step in the process for helping me to be able to experience true healing, which is what I hope for. You know, I want healing, and I don't want to be at the same place that I'm at. And so moving forward and healing, there's a lot of different parts to that, and trusting and asking God for it, and counseling and talking to my co-leaders and my pastors and my wife, and medication and reading books. All those things are kind of God is using, working together to help me experience healing in this area. So
yeah. And the last thing kind of somewhat relates to kind of what I was saying there at the end of my story, is directly walking into some of these core issues. And that is real painful, and that takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, and sometimes resources. But I think that I think if we expect to experience restoration and to experience wholeness, and I think of and John, you know, to I've come to give you life and give you life abundantly, you know, that we have to do that hard work, and that's difficult to do. And I think with the help of your, and that doesn't just have to come from a therapist or a counselor, but I think it comes from a multitude of people, about being open with the people in our lives, hearing that from them, being open with our family, maybe talking to a counselor or a pastor, but being open about what's going on and walking directly into those core issues and facing them, you know, rather than like turning away from them or avoiding them or numbing out with whatever it may be, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? Just walking directly into them. So, do you guys have any questions about anything we've shared, or any comments? I'd be happy to answer. We've got a few minutes, so we could do that.
This question's kind of obvious, but is there any validity to thinking that medication is running away from your problems? I mean, I know you kind of said that medication is important. I'm not trying to go against that in any way, this is my family's kind of always taught me that. So
yep.
I don't think it is. I can disagree with my family, but I'm kind of coming from their point of view. Is there any validity to
I'll repeat the question for you guys and the mic's sake. He said, is there any validity to maybe thinking that medication is a way of actually running away from your problems and not dealing with them? And so, do you have something you wanted to
do? Yeah. It's a good question. And I think for some people it could be, you know. For some people, thinking that you take some little pill and it's going to make you feel better because you don't want to deal with deeper things that are going on in your life, that is kind of running away from your problems. It's looking for an easy fix. But taking medication because you want to be healed, that you know, and we do that for all kinds of other diseases and struggles and physical problems and even chemical problems in our body. And so if medication is used with a process of, you know, all these things that we listed up here, I think that's actually facing your problems rather than running away from them. But I think it could be running away from them if you just think that, you know, because you can go to, probably most of you could go to your doctor and you tell them that you're feeling depressed, and probably most of your doctors will just prescribe you medication, you know.
And because they don't really have the time to invest, to understand where you're really coming from. And they know it's not going to hurt you to take that medicine. And it could potentially help you a little bit. But if you're not willing to kind of enter into a process of trying to be healed, trying to move toward greater wholeness, it may not really help you. And that could be kind of like running away from really facing your problems. So I think maybe both.
I concur. Other questions?
Yeah.
Kind of like how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that when you're like, okay, I'm obviously experiencing some ridiculous anxiety about this, and then you get more anxious about it.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. Do you want to repeat that question?
Yeah. I feel like I'm just talking to my microphone right now. The question was essentially when you start to get anxious about something, it's easy to get anxiety about your anxiety. And like, how do you stop that cycle of like building and building and building and building like that? Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah.
And I would say for myself, I'm not really sure how to deal with that. I mean, I used to memorize verses and I've heard in teachings that anxiety was a sin, you know? And so I'm thinking, I'm so anxious, but I cannot even escape my anxiety. So I'm just living in sin right now. And I have no escape from it. That makes me even more anxious. Because I'm not even trying to sin, but I'm sinning. And I think that for me, what I've found to be helpful is when I'm feeling really anxious to start talking to people. You know, so I'll talk to my wife about it. I'll talk to my counselor about it. I'll talk to my co-pastors about it. And sometimes that helps me kind of be down. Like I was, my wife wanted me to refinish this table while I was on my sabbatical. And what's that? Oh, wanted me to refinish my table. So I'm working on it. And as I'm working on it, I'm just getting more and more anxious thinking about things. And my thoughts are just multiplying. Because I'm thinking, I'm outside, and I have all these roofing materials in my garage, and I'm thinking about this roof that still hasn't gotten done on my house. And I'm just getting more and more and more and more anxious while I'm working on this. And I just started crying, and I was like, okay, I can feel myself kind of getting out of control, and it's multiplying, and I'm struggling. And so I just got on the phone. I think I called a couple people, and they're a couple people weren't around, but I got a hold of Jeff, who's one of my co-pastors, and I said, hey man, would it be okay if I just came over right now and talked to you? And he was like, yeah, come on over. And I went, drove over to his house, and we sat down. I'm telling him all these things, you know, these irrational thoughts. I know they're irrational thoughts, but I'm thinking them, struggling with them, and just listening to him comfort me, express truth into my heart, pray for me. You know, that I think that process does help me to just kind of let go of some of that. And that doesn't mean it doesn't come back the next day or whatever. But one of the things that my counselor has tried to help me get in touch with is realizing I'm an emotional person, and we all are very emotional people. And so when we start experiencing those emotions, learning how to express those, and I think especially for a lot of us guys, that's a hard thing, is to learn, okay, I'm feeling this, and so rather than just escape to my normal things that I do to try to get away from things, start expressing, okay, I am feeling whatever. She gave me like this sheet with a bunch of feeling words, and you know, that was her assignment. You have to like pick out one of these words, and it can't be angry, and it can't be whatever, frustrated. It has to be something else on this list to define your feelings. And that's surprisingly hard for me to do. And I thought I was pretty good at, you know, at expressing my emotions. But I think being able to express it when I start feeling it and talk to someone about it, that's helped me. But I have a lot of really good people in my life that I can talk to. that understand, and most of them aren't like me. They don't have the same, you know, they don't necessarily feel the same things, but they know me, they care about me, they love me, and they want to be a part of this journey with me. And so that's probably the biggest thing that's helped me. And then I can pray. Sometimes if I just try to start praying, one time I went over to a friend's house and I was trying to spend some time alone with God. I started praying and I had maybe one of the worst anxiety attacks I had from praying, because I just got out of control thinking about the possibilities of what could happen. And I was alone by myself at this person's house, and I had to call someone to come and pick me up because I was so scared. And that happened in a prayer time. And maybe I just wasn't praying very well or wasn't in tune with the Spirit. But when I was able to talk to someone a little bit, then we were able to pray together, and God really, you know, started working in my heart through that. So I don't know if that helps, but people, for me, being able to talk with someone who loves me, who really cares about me, has been really helpful.
Well, we need to be mindful of the time. If you guys have other questions, though, you want to come chat with us real quick, we'll hang out for a few minutes and talk. But
and I don't think the next seminar, now that other seminar on experiencing emotions, I think was happening up in that same room after us. I don't know that they're going to be meeting down here. So if some of you want to talk through some of the stuff, we can hang around and talk for a while.
Sure. About it, okay. Thanks.